This time last year, we announced a $54.3 billion projected shortfall. Today, we are announcing a projected $75.7 billion budget surplus. It's a remarkable turnaround. We talk about California coming back. I made the point at the State of the State a number of months ago, California's not coming back. California's going to come roaring back.
Governor Gavin Newsom today speaking in Oakland, where he unveiled his California comeback plan. The big news, more Californians would receive $600 stimulus checks, and some families with children would get $1,100. The governor also announced plans to help people pay rent they owe, and he wants to help more families pay for childcare. Here to tell us more is Nicole Nixon, politics reporter for CAP Radio in Sacramento. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. A year ago, as the governor mentioned, we were afraid, and he was warning of massive deficits because of COVID. And now he's talking about handing out $600 checks. So what happened?
Well, it's the story we've been hearing about for the past year. The top earners in the country, the top earners in California, did really well the last year while, you know, other people have been out of work and losing wages and all of those types of things. Because of California's tax structure, higher earners pay more in income taxes. There's also a tax on capital gains. So when the stock market's doing well, California's budget is doing really well too. And then we also have money coming in from the federal government that is separate from this stimulus proposal Newsom's proposing. So the federal money won't be going toward this, but, you know, all in all, it's a very good year for California's state budget.
Well, let's get into the details. How would this $600 stimulus payment work? Who gets it?
Yeah, so anybody earning less than $75,000 a year would get it. We should note that this is the second round of Golden State stimulus that Newsom has proposed. Earlier this year, he signed a bill to give $600 payments to lower-income families, undocumented workers who he pointed out were left out of federal relief. So this is an expansion of that, would double it. So he says two out of three Californians would get some a stimulus check here. This would be an actual check in the mail, I'm told. Of course, they have to pass this bill first, but the budget deadline is the end of June for Newsom to sign that. And I am told that people could be getting their checks 4 to 8 weeks after that. And then, of course, there's also an additional $500 for families, like you mentioned, like the governor mentioned. This is not per child. So if you have one kid, you get an extra $500. If you have, you know, four or five dependents, same amount, $500.
Mm-hmm. And this is also for families earning less than $75,000, or would it be for higher earners?
Yes, it would be for families earning under $7,500. Thanks for clarifying that.
Right. And so, as you mentioned, this does need to be approved by the state legislature. This is part of his budget. Do they seem inclined to do so?
I think they do. You know, he made this announcement. He was flanked by the budget chairman of the assembly and the budget chairwoman of the Senate. That is a very good sign for this proposal going through the legislature. Normally, these budget proposals are sort of gone over in negotiations with lawmakers, and not everything that the governor wants is able to make it out. But having those two very powerful lawmakers standing right beside him as he made this announcement, I think is a very good sign for Californians out there hoping to get their $600 check.
And not only that, he wants to double the state's rental assistance program. So what would that look like?
Yeah, I am not sure the size of this right now, but he mentioned doubling it. This is a kind of a squishy area because there aren't firm numbers out there of how much people owe right now. So he mentioned in this press conference that he's, going on the higher end just to be safe and because it sounds like there's money for it. And then in addition to rental assistance, he also wants to put up $2 billion to help people pay utility bills they've fallen behind on. And half of that would be dedicated to water bills.
Right. So here he is saying that.
We're also mindful rent is just one part of the burden of households. issues of gas, electricity, and water are real. So today we're announcing $2 billion of direct relief to pay down utility expenses, to pay off water, gas, and electricity needs.
Wow. Okay. So that's another big chunk of change. And as you mentioned, it seems that the legislature is behind him on this. Isn't he also obligated by state law to return a portion of the surplus to California residents under what's known as the GAM limit?
Yes, that's exactly right. And he was asked about that. This is kind of an interesting topic because he was asked about that. He said that that's not the reason he's doing this. And those can both be true. I just got off the phone with the Department of Finance, and they said that, you know, this GAN limit won't be finalized until 2 years from now. So he could do nothing. He could spend this money on other things. And then 2 years from now, it could be that the state owes people their tax rebate. This is him kind of getting out in front of it, saying, you know, right now. And also, the other thing to point out is that these numbers might change. But right now, the amount over the GAN limit that would have to go to back to taxpayers and to schools, it's split evenly, is $16 billion. So this is $8 billion back to taxpayers. Probably we'll see $8 billion of that to schools. But again, yeah, this doesn't need to happen now. He's just kind of getting out in front of it. And many people are, you know, pointing out that this is a governor who's under threat of a recall. And, you know, what better way to get people to support you than hand out stimulus checks?
Exactly. That seems pretty good to guarantee a warm feeling. Cold, hard cash. So this is just the beginning of several announcements that are going to trickle out this week, right? And you mentioned schools. He'll be announcing later how much schools will get.
I am not sure all of the announcements he'll be making later this week, but he said that, you know, this stimulus plan he announced is just one part of this huge $100 billion recovery plan. He is going to spend this whole week sort of putting out pieces of it. He said that this recovery plan will focus on California's most persistent problems. So I would guess that there will be a day dedicated to, you know, a plan and money toward homelessness and toward maybe wildfires and preparing for that. So I don't know exactly what they'll all be, but, you know, he's going to be out this week going around the state, explaining ways he wants to spend this big budget windfall.
Nicole Nixon, politics reporter for Cap Radio in Sacramento. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up, what happened to the people living in tents at Echo Park Lake? The park is being cleaned up. They were offered housing. We'll find out if they took it. That's next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In March, hundreds of people protested at Echo Park against the city's decision to remove a homeless encampment along the lake. About 200 people were living there. More than 160 of them moved into hotels or shelters, and the city has been cleaning up the park since then. They say they removed 35 tons of trash, and that included drug paraphernalia, gasoline, tons of biological waste. The park is expected to reopen by the end of the month, but with a homelessness problem more visible than ever in Los Angeles and pressures mounting to find solutions, residents in other neighborhoods are wondering if what happened in Echo Park is just the beginning. which neighborhoods may be cleared out next, and what happens to the people who are cleared out. Benjamin Oreskes has been following this story. He's a reporter with the LA Times who covers housing and homelessness. Hi there, Ben.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. All right, so what does Echo Park Lake look like now, and what's been happening since it was cleared out in late March?
If you were to go down there today, you would see a large fence surrounding this park, which is sort of the center of public life in Echo Park. On a given day, you would see vendors in there, you'd see swan boats out on the lake. And ever since the park was cleared of tents and closed, they have been doing various different forms of renovation, resodding the grass, updating the toilets, and making sure it's restored to what it had looked like before, which had been the stated goal of the councilman for the district, Mitch O'Farrell, and the Recreation and Parks Department for the city.
Okay. And as I said in the intro, that involved removing tons and tons of waste. Did they expect there to be such a huge trash removal problem?
I think it isn't a surprise that there would be this much trash. As you mentioned, there were over 170 tents. People had been living in that park for over a year and really had created a community. There was a kitchen. There was massive, massive tents where people had solar panels, had TVs, various different other things that sort of made it feel very permanent. So that is what contributed to this large amount of waste that was pulled out of the park. We should add that, you know, the city's removal of trash from homeless encampments is very controversial and has been relentlessly criticized by activists who contend that in the process of doing this, they throw out people's possessions. So that number also likely included some amount of stuff that people considered theirs. The city also went to great lengths to store people's possessions in facilities that they have across the city. There were about 239 items that were stored. This includes large boxes that they put people's stuff in. And it's not clear how much of that stuff has been retrieved by the people who have been living in the park. But the sanitation department, in the days after the park was cleared, you know, sort of created a map and knew exactly where people's stuff was. So if a homeless person came to the city and said, I left things there, they could kind of map it out and figure out where their stuff may have been and where it might be now.
Well, where did the people go? More importantly, 160 or so actually took the city's offer for housing. Is that right?
Yeah. So in the months and weeks leading up to the clearance of the park, outreach workers from LASA, the Homeless Service Authority, and other agencies had spent a lot of time getting people out of the park and putting them in hotels that were rented by the city and county and other along with other forms of interim housing. As you said, many people took them up on that offer so that by the last days before the park was closed, which was very sudden because they didn't actually tell anyone this was going to happen, there weren't that many people left in the park. But it's not clear where those people have gone who didn't take them up on that offer. You know, I can tell you I was one of the last people to leave the park, and I saw many people sort of walk out back to the streets. Other people got help from sort of community aid groups like Ground Game LA and the DSA. But now, a month or two later, it's not clear where everyone was. Of course, anecdotally, I've heard from people who are still in these hotels. These hotels we expect to stay open until September. That's when the federal government has been reimbursing the city at 100% of the cost of these hotels. That's when that subsidy expires. So we should expect people to be staying in them until they close. And then where they go from there, it still remains to be seen.
Yeah. So what happens when they open the park back up, which is expected at the end of this month? Will people move back in and set up another tent encampment?
It's a really good question. I have not gotten as clear of an answer on that as I would have liked. There are specific rules in the municipal code that ban sleeping in parks. And we should expect that those laws will be enforced. Much of the reason for why this encampment grew in size was partially because of restrictions around clearing encampments that the CDC had suggested. And as COVID restrictions relax, and the city and county open back up, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a more stringent enforcement of these rules in parks. But again, we have not heard from local officials who have offered sort of very specific guidance on what that would look like. But I would not be surprised if we see a lot of sort of protest around this exact point. When an encampment starts to grow, will people be cleared suddenly? That's sort of the question.
And what about in other parts of the city? In Venice, there's a similar situation happening right on the beachfront there. There's an encampment of more than 200 tents, and a group is pushing the councilman there, Mike Bonin, to do something similar. Is that going to happen? Is it going to happen in other parts of the city?
After what we saw play out in Echo Park happened, there was a huge amount of upswing in discussion about solutions like what we saw. We heard from constituent groups saying, why won't this happen in our neighborhood? Why won't this happen here? I think that Echo Park was a very unique situation. It was a very sort of self-contained space. I think it'd be very difficult to fence off, you know, several miles of the boardwalk. That being said, Angelenos I've heard from are very frustrated by these large encampments that block the right of way and sort of the attendant chaos that comes with them. That said, there aren't enough places for everyone to go. And Councilman Bonin has been at the forefront of trying to create solutions. Those solutions, though, have been met with pushback. He's proposed, you know, using parking lots for safe sleep sites, you know, using parking lots by the beach for RV shelters. So I think that our politicians are really straining, looking for solutions to kind of placate Angelenos' biggest frustration, which is about these large encampments that are right up against their homes or in their communities where they go for walks.
Right. But at the same time, then these residents don't want a city-sanctioned sort of semi-permanent situation, as you mentioned, creating places for these tent encampments in parking lots or elsewhere.
That has been a challenge in certain locations where people kind of look at this and say, we want a solution, but this one's too close to a school, or we want a solution and this one's too close to a playground. I think that we are seeing a lot of sort of hand-wringing around ideas like that. At the same time, though, we have seen an expansion of things like shelter. We've seen tiny villages go up in North Hollywood. We've seen our first safe sleep site that's not on the VA in East Hollywood. So there are things that are being done. I just don't think that they're being done at a scale that will placate the needs or the frustrations of residents in a way that would sort of create that visible change that a lot of Angelenos want. And as we kind of enter an election year where homelessness will probably be one of the biggest issues, I think we should expect to see more discussion of more interim options that satisfy the desires of Angelenos to make the streets cleaner and safer.
Benjamin Oreskes covers housing and homelessness for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that crisis may soon be solved by someone else, or at least tackled by someone else. Maybe. Last week, Axios broke the news that the White House is considering Mayor Eric Garcetti for a high-profile diplomatic post, ambassador to India. It's not the first time his name has been floated for a gig in the Biden administration, but that other job, transportation secretary, ultimately went to someone else, and that is Pete Buttigieg. So what would happen if Garcetti were to leave before the end of his term? We're going to talk about that now with our legal Jessica Levinson. She teaches at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Hi.
Well, what happens if he leaves? Who will lead this city?
Well, you know, arguably a lot and a little. So the first thing it will kick off is that there will be this race before the race to become the interim mayor. We all know that this is Mayor Garcetti's last term, that there'll be an open seat. People have already declared for the next election, but we'll have this likely jockeying before that if he does, in fact, vacate his seat, because the charter allows either for the city council to appoint the next person or for there to be a special election. I suspect there won't be a special election because of time and cost. So you're going to see a lot of people, you know, with very big in-person or virtual grins looking at the city council, hoping it's their lucky day. And the reason I said, you know, a lot and a little is because in Los Angeles, of course, the mayor has a very powerful position, but we also do have a system of decentralized power. So, you know, a lot could change in the sense that there'll be questions about what will happen to his staff, what should the commissioners do, what will happen to his initiatives and goals. But we know that every, you know, 4 to 8 years, we do have a mayoral turnover, and it arguably doesn't always, you know, radically change our city that much.
Right. But is the uncertainty itself could be destabilizing, right? That we don't know. Will he stay? Will he go? So who should we look to make long-term decisions, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it could be destabilizing. I think it is destabilizing. And of course, it really has been for quite a while now. I mean, what was it, about 10 seconds after the mayor won his reelection, people said, oh, is he going to run for mayor? Excuse me, for president. And or maybe it was even before he won his reelection campaign. So that plagued him for a long time. Will he run for president? Then he said no. So he declared he was not running before he ever declared that he was running. Then, as you said, there was a question about will he become a member of the cabinet, maybe the transportation secretary. That didn't happen. Now will he become an ambassador? And, you know, if this doesn't happen, then there'll be something else. I mean, this is like the most consistent destabilizing thing in Los Angeles politics now. Will the mayor stay or go?
Well, if he stays, if he's not offered the post and he stays, or if he is offered the post and he stays, he's still out. You know, this is his right. last year. So any speculation as to A, who would fill his seat in the normal course of events, and B, where he would go?
Well, I think let's take door number two. Let's take B first, maybe, where he would go. You know, the being the LA mayor, while it's very high profile, obviously we're a major city in America, it's not typically a springboard. I mean, let's look at the past 3, 5, 10 mayors. We're not talking about people who later became governors or senators or presidents. The mayor is young. He's ambitious. I think the reason we have all these conversations about will he take on a national profile is that he knows that he needs something to, you know, for lack of a better way of describing it, kind of cleanse himself of this mayoral position, have a degree cleanse, so to speak, and gain either a national or international profile. You know, in terms of who's jockeying, the city attorney is running for election for the open seat. There's a Mike Fuhrer. There's a member of the city council, Buscaino, who's running to be the next mayor. And then we're waiting on a bunch of people. We're waiting on people like Rick Caruso. We're waiting on people who are outside the city government. It's a long and short ways away. And then, of course, the city council president, Nuri Martinez, has said, I'm seriously looking at this, and she would be a historic candidacy.
Maybe John Cox and his bear. Who knows?
No, I know. The answer to that is no.
Definitely not the bear. Okay. Moving on to another topic. Last week, a bar owner in a small town in the San Joaquin County was arrested for selling fake COVID vaccine cards. And apparently some undercover agents bought 4 fake cards from the bar, and they paid about $20 a piece. The AP reports the agents wrote their names and birth dates on Post-it notes. And then the bar employees cut the cards, filled in the information, and voila. Doesn't sound exactly legal. What kind of punishment would that entail?
It's not exactly legal. And, you know, so much of what we talk about is, well, is it illegal? What are the potential laws? In this case, we know it's not legal. And so what are we looking at here? Identity theft, potentially in this case of Pfizer, CVS, and in fact, the CDC. We're looking at forging government documents, including wrongfully using government seals, falsifying medical records. So there are a whole bunch of state and, in fact, federal charges here. In terms of how, you know, how long the sentences would be, we don't know. Luckily, we're not hearing a ton about these particular cases. Again, in part, they're fairly serious federal and state violations. And also, look, as an employee, you're very likely to lose your job if you do this. If you're a student, you're very likely to be kicked out of school if you do this. So there are serious repercussions.
But it does bring up the other bigger argument, and that is these vaccination cards, are they in fact legal documents?
Well, I think they're masquerading as legal documents, and I think people will try and use them as legal. It's almost like a fake ID. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can make one at home. Well, I have no artistic skill, so I can't make one at home, but somebody can make one at home and then try and get access to a bunch of things. And that's the same idea here. You know, people want to, what do you want to gain access to? I can continue to be an employee and be on site, or I can be a student and be on campus, or I can get on this plane, or I can go to this concert. So there, people are trying to use it for a real and specific and sometimes legal purpose, but they're not, in fact, legal documents.
But the real ones are. That's what I'm asking.
Yes, I think the real
legitimate ones.
The legitimate ones are. And in fact, I think that employers, schools have a legitimate basis to say, you want to come back? We want to see your vaccine card. Again, as long as the employers and schools give a carve out for medical issues or religious issues.
Right. And don't the vaccines have to have permanent authorization, not emergency use authorization, for schools to require vaccination and require the cards to be used in that way?
So there's some question about whether or not you can, you have to wait as an employer or as a school administrator for the vaccines to get off of emergency use authorization before you mandate them. I would say, I think the better legal argument at this point is that you don't have to wait for these vaccines to get off emergency use authorization, particularly with respect to private schools. If you notice the announcement from the UCs and the Cal State saying, get a vaccine, it's going to be required before you go back to campus, they actually say once it's off of emergency use authorization. But this is, again, a bit of a novel question, but I think the better legal conclusion is, you, particularly as a private employer, you can require this, particularly as a private school, you can require this even during emergency use authorization, again, as long as you have those carve-outs for medical issues and religious issues.
All right, Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, it is Monday. Happy Monday. And it is still our drive to the future. So this is actually the final day to support both KCRW and help prevent and end homelessness, because part of your donation in this early part of our drive will help provide legal aid for people experiencing homelessness. We just talked about the homelessness situation here in Los Angeles, how it's a big, big problem. Well, this is one way to help solve it. So your donation goes twice as far. And in fact, it goes even further, because we have a $20,000 challenge grant to double your impact. So you give a dollar and we get another dollar from our KCRW champions. So now is a perfect time to donate, to renew your membership or become a new member at kcrw.com, 800-600-5279. Thank you. Coming up, how unfunny was Elon?
But don't worry, I'm pretty good at running human in emulation mode.
An assessment of Elon Musk on Saturday Night Live and of the show, now that it no longer has the Trump White House to skewer. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Saturday Night Live welcomed Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk to 30 Rock over the weekend.
To anyone I've offended, I just want to say I reinvented electric cars and I'm sending people to Mars in a rocket ship. Did you think I was also going to be a chill, normal dude?
Well, the billionaire's appearance definitely left an impression on the internet, and not a good one. People generally panned his appearance. But a hotly contested host is nothing new for SNL. Back in 2015, then presidential hopeful Donald Trump hosted the program. SNL's ratings have been sinking over the last few weeks. What is to blame? Joining me to discuss the episode and SNL in general is New York Times culture reporter Dave Itzkoff. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. What did you think of that episode?
Well, you know, I think it was, at the end of the day, this is going to sound completely banal, but it was literally an episode of Saturday Night Live hosted by Elon Musk. It wasn't any more than that. It wasn't any less than that. It wasn't used as an opportunity to really savage him in any way. There were a lot of sketches that, you know, he appeared in, but weren't necessarily built around him. And then a couple of sketches that where he was sort of the central character, and they were exceedingly polite to him, let's say, which I think given all the sort of build up and anticipation and expectation around this episode is perhaps a little different than, you know, I think what people were tuning in for.
Right. It certainly had a huge build up, and I guess it was maybe bound to disappoint on that score. But what were people upset about? Why were they so worked up over the fact that he was hosting in the first place?
Well, I think it's a very it's a threshold that the show is crossing in just in terms of the talent pool that they're looking for in terms of their hosts. And that's their decision, of course. But if you look over their history, it's almost entirely been entertainers, certainly people from film and TV and stand-up comedy. Gradually, of course, they have built out into the world of politics and people like anyone from Ed Koch to Rudy Giuliani to, as you mentioned, Donald Trump, you know, have hosted in kind of political modes. But you're not really going to find anyone in the 46-year history of the show who came from the world of business, with the exceptions of maybe George Steinbrenner, who hosted in 1990, and you know, he was a pretty well-known New York character at the time. And you know, one year as a goof, they let Brandon Tartikoff host the show when he was you know, the head of NBC Entertainment. Mm-hmm. So there's really nothing analogous in the show's history like this. And even though you know, Elon Musk is a public figure and a kind of celebrity in his own right, it is just, it raises eyebrows when they start bringing in CEOs and executives to host their program. Mm-hmm. And then the show is a little bit bound up then in whoever they choose. What happens if something happens at Tesla or at SpaceX or in Musk's own life? And they, you know, suddenly they're the ones left holding the bag. Why did you have that person on your show?
Right, especially when he's made controversial comments about vaccines and you know, other things that people are, you know, he's made irresponsible comments about vaccines. Let's put it that way.
Certainly.
And also,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and also cryptocurrency. So there was a bit where he kind of talked about this cryptocurrency that he's been promoting before the show. And let me just play a little clip of that.
Sure. Well, break a leg tonight. I love you very much.
I love you too, Mom.
And I'm excited for my Mother's Day gift. I just hope it's not Dogecoin.
It is.
Okay, so that's the cryptocurrency, Dogecoin. And then he went on and referenced it again during the Weekend Update segment. That was a head scratcher for me, because then the actual value of this thing went down after he had tried to promote on the show.
I think, I mean, people in the crypto world, I think, were certainly expecting that he was going to name check it, and that it would be that would be positive for Dogecoin, that its value would go up based on it, and that's not what happened. But yeah, even it's kind of a weird thing, because on the one hand, when you have a more sort of run of the mill celebrity hosting SNL, we of course expect them to plug their latest film or TV show or album, whatever it is. And yet when you know, you've got Elon Musk just sort of, you know, just blatantly name dropping a cryptocurrency that he's been touting, it just feels a little unsavory. It's hard to pinpoint exactly why, but it just feels strange. It, you know, it's like if you just went up on the stage with a big, you know, Mountain Dew banner wrapped around your body, that would feel weird too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so how does this fit in with the general trend of SNL? And as I mentioned, it has been losing viewers over recent weeks. Where is it in the cultural conversation?
Well, I think it's certainly made a huge splash in terms of getting people to talk about the show in the run up to it. This was, we've just had for them a presidential election season, if you count, you know, the latter half of 2020, and that is always a huge driver for them. People watching just to see, you know, who's playing, the presidential hopefuls on the show. How are they parodying or satirizing the news events and the election? And then once you get past that, then there is always a little bit of a kind of, you know, some empty space that they have to fill, or they have to find ways of kind of keeping that momentum going. And so in that sense, you can understand why they might kind of gravitate to a stunt like this, that it's a way of just kind of keeping people, keeping attention on the show, and even perhaps bringing in some viewers who weren't tuning in otherwise, or maybe had checked out for a little while. But it's hard to imagine this setting any, I mean, look, maybe I'll be completely contradicted at the start of next season. It's hard to imagine this setting a kind of precedent, in the sense that who else can they find that's going to sort of occupy the same space as Musk? I mean, even somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, I mean, they've had him do cameos on the show. It'd be hard to conceive of him hosting an entire episode, but maybe that's the next threshold.
Another not-so-funny billionaire, David Itzkoff, covers film, television, and comedy for The New York Times. Thank you.
Thanks for having me over.
Coming up, the women who shaped electronic music. The director of the new documentary, Sisters with Transistors, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Electronic music is a global phenomenon, and it is largely a male phenomenon. All of the highest paid electronic music acts in the world are men, such as the Chainsmokers, Calvin Harris, Tiesto. But the pioneers of electronic music were women, beginning in the early part of the 20th century. And their story is told in a new documentary called Sisters with Transistors.
The machine was alive. It was warm. It communicated. It was sensitive. You know, you could move something just the littlest bit, and a whole new expression would open up.
That's composer Suzanne Ciani. We're going to talk about her and the other women in this film now with Lisa Rovner, who directed Sisters with Transistors. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that quote from Suzanne Ciani. She almost makes it sound like the machine is a person. I think at one point she calls them sensual. Why is that? Because, you know, probably most people look at machines as these cold, hard, inanimate objects, not as something sensual or something human-like. Normally we'd look at something like a cello as more human-like. At least the shape of it looks like the shape of a woman. Why did they have this, I don't know, very intimate feeling for these machines?
I mean, I really think it was just really because these machines liberated them. They enabled them. They, you know, were able to help them express themselves in a way that wasn't possible before them. They were intimately, I mean, to master these machines, I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried to dabble on a synthesizer. It takes a lot of work and time. So it's like, I guess we all have that kind of relationship with our phones now and our computers. But yeah, I don't know exactly why they describe it in that way, but I can only assume it's because they were so enabled by them.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. And you begin your movie at the early part of the 20th century, and you focus on a few pioneering women composers in this field in Britain. And interestingly, draw the comparison between the sounds of war and the electronic music that they created and were drawn to. Was that their primary influence? Was the Blitz and the war and the bombs falling on Britain?
Yeah, so that is, I think the connection between electronic music and war is very interesting, not only in terms of certain sounds inspiring Delia Derbyshire and her work at the Radiophonic Workshop, but also the possibility that this war created for women to enter radio. Daphne Oram was aged just 18 when she started working at the BBC as a sound engineer. And she was galvanized by, you know, the ongoing developments in audio technology. And she devoted all of her free time to exploring new ways to make sounds with electronics. But one of the things that I think is so fascinating about all of these women, one of the things that really connects them all, is how they listen actively, not only to the sounds that they create, but to the sounds around them. Delia Derbyshire talks about, you know, the sounds of the air raid sirens as being electronic music, and that perhaps her love for abstract sound comes from the sounds of the war.
That is really interesting because, I mean, normally you would think that that would inspire terror, not, you know, not beauty. The sounds of a falling bomb or an air raid siren.
Yeah, but I feel like in early electronic music, you really hear the angst. You know, that early electronic music in Britain, so it was mainly created at the BBC radio station, and it was mainly created for radio dramas. And a lot of the writers at the time were kind of writing in this very surreal and kind of weird, you know, a legacy of the war, really. And so those sounds, that those early electronic sounds, they do have that scary kind of eerie quality to them.
Let's play a clip from Daphne Oram. She was a pioneering female composer, also at the BBC. And this is her talking about her studio and how she would make the tones that she was looking for.
Well, let me introduce this little electronic generator here, which produces a sound like this. Now, I've made a little loop of tape here with varying pure tones on it. Now, if I then put a little artificial reverberation on that, I think you'll see we're just beginning to get somewhere on little music.
Tell us about her, Daphne Oram. Was she trained as a musician, a conventional musician initially?
So she was, she had a place at the Royal Academy of Music, but instead decided to go work at the BBC as a sound engineer. So she began her career in the early 40s and was really the driving force to the Radiophonic Workshop, where most of the recognizable electronic music from the 50s, 60s, and 70s was created. The Radiophonic Workshop created the famous Doctor Who soundtrack. And she was just passionate about electronic music and co-founded the Radiophonic Workshop, but then very quickly left because the BBC were really more interested in creating sounds for drama. She was more interested in exploring the possibilities of electronic music. So she, in 1959, she opened the Oramics Studios, and she was one of the first women to have a private electronic music studio in England. And she dedicated the rest of her life to drawn sound technique, something that she called the Oramics machine. And really what it was about, it was that she wanted a system where she could graphically represent sound. And so basically you would draw the sound and the machine would create sound. But if you think about how people are making music today with the technology that people are using, you know, it's all graphically represented. So in so many ways, she was so ahead of her time. You know, people kind of, they don't necessarily draw, but they, you know, you see a shape and you can manipulate that shape in software. She was really at the forefront of that.
Right, because at the time people were using tape and these old tape machines to make this music.
Yeah, and so of course the tape machines, they came out of, you know, wartime needs for improved means of communication. And what was amazing about the tape recorder was that it was suddenly possible to record and manipulate sounds in ways that were unimaginable before. So tape became more than just a means for recording and playing back. It became a tool for a composition.
What was the reaction to this music at the time and to the women who were composing it?
Well, can you imagine seeing Clara Rockmore playing a theremin in 1932? So the theremin is this wild instrument that you don't touch. You kind of sculpt the air. So I can only imagine what it must have been like. I mean, people must have thought that she was some kind of witch. But really until the late 60s, people didn't really like electronic music. B.B. Baron, her and Louis Baron's score for Forbidden Planet wasn't credited as electronic music. It was credited as electronic tonalities. People were afraid of electronic music. People were afraid of machines in general. You know, the machines were, and just like the computers, they belong to the banks and the insurance companies and the big corporations. You know, this music was, it was not exactly accepted or liked.
But then people saw it as instrumental or a good use for it in commercial projects, right? Like, well, film soundtracks, the music to commercials on TV, on the radio.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, a lot of these women made their living thanks to soundtracking. So Suzanne Ciani famously did the Coca-Cola, the pop and pour Coca-Cola ad. And actually all of these women worked scoring films and television adverts.
Why were women drawn to this in the first place and you know, sought refuge, if you will, and freedom in this particular art form?
Yeah, so Laurie Spiegel explains in the film that, you know, women were drawn to electronic music when the possibility of a woman composing was in itself controversial. So electronics really enabled women. It was a way for women composers to be heard by others without having to be taken seriously by the male-dominated establishment. Electronics basically meant that women could do it all themselves. It was a very DIY aspect to making electronic music. You could, you know, as Suzanne Ciani says, you were the composer, you were the performer, you were the sole arbiter of your creation. And you could really, thanks to these machines, get your compositions out to the world. So you didn't need to hire an orchestra. You didn't need to get a grant in order to hire the orchestra. It was just a way of bypassing all of these patriarchal structures.
Mm. Yes. And a musician named Ramona Gonzalez, she talks about that in your movie. Here's a clip from that.
What relates all of these women is this DIY thing. And DIY is interesting because it doesn't mean that you've explicitly, voluntarily chosen to do it yourself. It's that there are certain barriers in place that don't allow you to do anything. If you don't have the visual or the knowledge of there being any people in the area of work that you're interested in that are similar to you, then you don't think that it's possible for you.
Hmm. So why did these women think that this was possible for them? Because when you think of computers and electronics, you do see it is a male-dominated field.
Well, I think this set of women are truly remarkable women. You know, these were women with agency. I mean, this is what's so fascinating. You know, we all, as younger women, you know, as a filmmaker, as a director, you know, you're constantly looking for role models. And these women didn't really have any. It makes me think you don't really need role models, but I know how powerful a role model can be. You know, the thing that really drew me to these women is that they represented women as creators. You know, so many women that we learn about and that we see are kind of cast as muse, not so often as creators. And that was why I was so drawn to them. That's why I was so drawn to telling their stories. There's something so inspiring as a young woman creator to kind of discover that there were many, not just one, because I think that's the problem, is that when we just kind of single out one person, and this is what I wanted to do with the film, was kind of show, actually, it wasn't just one person, there were many.
Lisa Rovner, director of Sisters with Transistors, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And Sisters with Transistors is available now on video on demand. Wow, that music is so trippy. I just want to keep listening to it. Unfortunately, we are at the end of the show. And the beginning of the week, and another week to ask you to support your full-service public radio station. Not only do you hear the music that inspires you and challenges you on a radio station. You find out the stories behind it. And if that is something that you love and you want to support, you can do it now at KCRW.com and become a member today. And thank you. That's it for our show today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.